Welcome to Vox Vomitus, also known as Word Vomit.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Vox Vomitus, otherwise known as Word Vomit. I am your host, Jennifer Ann Gordon, the author of the award-winning novel Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, as well as the Hotel series and Pretty Ugly. Joining me today, as always, is my Vox Vomitus vixen, Allison Martine, author of the Bourbon books, including the award-winning novel Dibs since September and Move on Melinda. With us today is Amanda Giatissa, and she is here to talk about her fantastic debut novel, My Sweet Girl. If this had accidentally gone live 5 seconds earlier, you would have seen us, Allison and I, just geeking out right at poor Amanda about how much we loved her book. So Amanda,
she's already put up with a lot, honestly.
She's put up with a lot already. So Amanda, thank you for being here. Tell our audience and our listeners a little bit about yourself and a little bit of spoiler-free stuff about My Sweet Girl.
Sure thing. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. It's actually 4:30 in the morning in Sri Lanka, where I am right now.
What?
Wait, you were in San Francisco. 4:30 in the morning?
We changed the time for you, Amanda.
It's fine. I'm totally used to it because obviously all publishing news and like emails and things come in the middle of the night. So now I've completely readjusted a lot of my schedule.
You're basically a vampire.
Mm-hmm. Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's not bad, but it's a lot more quiet at this time, so it's a really good time actually to chat and stuff. I just have this really creepy vision of like everything's dark outside, and you know when it's dark outside and you kind of don't know what's out there. So I have this like little paranoia.
Mohini is out there.
Yeah. Which brings us. oh God. I've dressed up as Mohini when I was younger to scare my cousin. To do that to me, it just would be interesting karma.
have you sent your cousins this book? Did you go, hey, look at this?
Yeah.
Mohini's out to get you.
Okay. Yeah, we always knew you were obsessed with like ghost stories, and I guess there's proof. So.
And now you're getting paid. So.
Sorry.
Now you're getting paid, so it's like, hey, who's obsessed now?
Exactly. and about the book, so My Sweet Girl,
back cover.
It's about a woman named Paloma who finds her blackmailing roommate dead in their San Francisco apartment, and she obviously freaks out and kind of flees the apartment. But when the police get there, they can't find any trace of the body or even any evidence that this roommate even existed to begin with. Paloma is convinced, though, that all these events are somehow tied into her childhood in Sri Lanka and the orphanage where she grew up and the questionable choices that she made to get out of there. It features Mohini, which is the ghost that we were just talking about, who is one of Sri Lanka's, I think, most popular urban myths, kind of. If you're a Sri Lankan or you've spent time here, you've definitely met somebody or you know somebody who has 100% seen Mohini. It's like, there's no questions asked. Like, I have so many, even like friends of mine who swear that they've seen her.
I love that.
Me too.
I'm like, yes.
Well, and I'm kind of picturing her like a Sri Lankan La Llorona, like,
yes!
I don't know if you're familiar, like that, because yes. I don't feel like just Anglo-America, we don't have something equivalent, so I think we have
the generic white lady.
Yeah, lady in white, but she doesn't have a cool name.
Nope.
No, she doesn't.
No.
She's the bride who got left behind, or the one who got killed. Yeah, and she doesn't have a cool backstory.
She always dies on a bridge or is left on a bridge.
Jen, that's the first episode of Supernatural.
I know.
Okay. And Mohini never showed up in Supernatural or Grimm, and this is where I get my folklore from. So this was like a whole new thing for me. So thank you for introducing that to me, because now I have something new to be terrified of. Thank you very much.
I immediately went to Google just to make sure this was a real urban myth, because I was like, oh, is she making this up, or is it something I can legitimately now be scared of?
Well, yeah, like, yes, been,
something I can be scared of.
Because, yeah, because Paloma's background, you said it's her background in Sri Lanka, and she's from an orphanage. So it could have been something, like, really specific to, like, oh, it haunts the orphanage. So what we had, the church camp I grew up, we had Fireman Fred, who will come and get you in the middle of the night. So you watch out for... But see, Fireman Fred doesn't really sound that scary.
That doesn't sound terrifying.
Fireman Fred, he sounds like he has a kindergarten show, honestly. Like, he's on Disney Junior. Yeah.
Like, Fireman he's definitely going to help you prevent forest fires.
Yeah, no. He's supposed to hack you to bits, so...
Nice.
Not for the toddler set.
No, I did at first think about inventing my own ghost. And I did kind of in the early drafts venture down that path, but it wasn't working for me. It wasn't clicking. I mean, this was that like penultimate horror story that I grew up listening to or hearing and retelling and dressing up like to scare people. So it just seemed like the right thing to do, to kind of like pay homage to like Sri Lankan folklore, which a lot of people might not have been exposed to. And you're right, it is very similar to sort of La Llorona. I think a lot of cultures do have this sort of woman in white figure, especially across a lot of Asian countries as well. So yeah, it was just a lot of fun to incorporate this mostly female presence in the book.
So I love that you've dressed up as her and you did it to terrify people. And
I just
like,
kind of said she's not dressed like that now.
Up like sexy Mohini. You know?
Sexy Mohini.
Like, sexy Mohini. Yeah. That sounds like a cocktail. Don't you feel like that's like
next Halloween? Like,
sexy Mohini. Or it's like that is the cocktail that should, like, you know how like a lot of books have book clubs and cocktail recipes?
Oh,
you need to have the sexy Mohini. But it has to be sad, like something Paloma would drink. So it's just like cooking sherry
and a handful of pills.
Yeah, it's like Ambien and scotch. That's the sexy Mohini.
Well, okay, but that's actually a good point because, as you said, so they come back and the police are like, hey, by the way, there's no dead roommate. Are you sure you even have a roommate? And there's no sign of this guy. And that's one of the big things is she's been told, you're not supposed to be drinking on the medication that you're on. So there's this whole element of, is she seeing any of this? Or is she just literally losing her shit? That's what she's losing. She's like, what? I don't know. And the number of times where it's like, wait, how many pills have you taken? How much have you? I don't know how much I drank. I don't even know when it is or where I am.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously this concept of an unreliable narrative, and because she's drinking or because she's making her drink with her meds, which she's not supposed to do, it's not revolutionary, right? In this genre, it's actually pretty common to a point right now. It's almost a little bit of a cliche. But I really wanted to bring in this angle and focus it on a brown woman because it adds a whole new depth of what's going on. Because a lot of the characters that we do see are, you know, they do kind of fit into a certain box, right? They're usually sort of, you know, mid-30s white women, suburban setting, and
they look like me, but 10 years younger.
Xanax problem. Oops.
Yeah, like I said, me, but 10 years younger.
Are you saying you were a wine mom with a Xanax problem 10 years ago?
Did I have Xanax? I didn't have Xanax. I'm not on Xanax now. That's not what they gave me. It didn't work for me. Point is, it's all like soccer mom with like the three martini lunch or, you know, going through bottles of wine, like their sippy cups. And it's a very narrow, it's like, hey.
And kids at like a really amazing private
narrators.
School.
It's all the same narrators. So yeah, Paloma was definitely different.
I read very widely in the genre and I really enjoy the genre. So I'm like, I'm not knocking on any of that. All I'm saying is that I thought it was interesting because we don't really see brown women in feature in this genre. Right? They're rarely the main characters. And just that adjustment brings in a whole other level of issues and problems and things that, you know, she has to deal with. This whole model minority idea that she feels so strongly that she has to portray this certain, you know, type of a personality almost, and you don't see that. Like, you don't see her being a Karen, and she's very, very conscious of the fact that she doesn't want to be a Karen. You know, she's got the smile, she's got that like jaw.
Be nice, Paloma. Be kind. Be my sweet girl, Paloma.
Yeah,
exactly. Which I
do regret indeed.
Yeah. I mean, we've all felt that way at some point, I'm sure. But I felt that pressure a lot, especially when I was living in the US and in the UK. So it is a dimension that I wanted to bring into the story as well.
Well, you handled it really perfectly to do that. But one of the things that you mentioned is, so her mother, her parents, they're adopted parents. And so some of that she's even getting internally. And I really liked even how you were exploring the issue of intercultural international adoptions and how that looks and how it looks from both sides of the parents' expectations and the children's expectations. And there was one line that, it just broke me, where she was trying to have her mom learn to speak the language that she grew up in. And her mom's like, "Oh, you already know how to speak Sri Lankan." And she's like, "I didn't even have the heart to tell her that there's no language Sri Lankan." Like, her mother doesn't even know the name of the language that this child is speaking, let alone making any effort to connect with her on a heart level to be able to speak to her in her own language. And that just, I mean, if there was one takeaway line that I just was broken by, it was that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, obviously on a personal level, I've experienced a lot of very interesting kind of reactions to where I'm from, right? There is, there are people who are like, "Oh, Sri Lanka, where's that?" So that's just India, right? That's like,
I loved that line. It's like, oh yeah, I know where that is. It's in India.
It's something I hear all the time, really. But, and there is a lot of, there are a lot of people who also like, "Oh, Sri Lanka, like, that is so cool. Like, that, it's really cool." And then there's really no like learning or understanding or finding out much about me except like, "Oh, like, you guys have elephants, right?" And it's so
you have
funny.
Elephants and you look exotic and you use coconut products in your hair.
Yeah, it's all about being exotic. It's really funny, and it's, for me, it was very funny because I think when I was 15 or 16 and my first trip to the US, it was sort of a school group type situation where we met out, you know, people our age, or children our age, from other countries. And I would just say the most outlandish things. I'd be like, "Yeah, you know, I have a pet elephant. I ride it to school." And they would all believe me. With
monkeys sleep in my bed with me. You know,
like, where do you think I'm from? Like, Narnia? Like, it's not the same. Yeah, but there was a lot of that. And of course, I did speak to a lot of people who've been gone through adoption, and a lot of Sri Lankans who've been adopted by typically white families, and people from other cultures who've been adopted by white families, and how they've felt about that process. Of course, I have to say that a lot of them, like a large majority of them, did not have experiences anywhere close to Paloma's. That was a little exaggerated, obviously. But it was very interesting for me also to consider orphanages and how they are run. In Sri Lanka, it's very common, I think, for us to be involved, I think, from a very young age in various charities and things like that. It's very much a part of the culture. So I have, like, growing up, we would spend a lot of time at orphanages. I've volunteered at a lot of orphanages. My family works closely with a lot of orphanages. So you do get exposed to certain things. And one thing that I was very conscious about was trying not to portray this orphanage as a systematically terrible place. It is, of course, it is creepy and gothic, and there's a whole load of issues to unpack there. But it was of one of your like Oliver Twist orphanages, if that makes sense.
Because, yeah, they weren't starving to death. I loved the nuances of like, "Oh, I wore a pink Barbie t-shirt that had glitter on it." Like, I, you know, they had books, they had everything, they had friends. They had, you know, a ghost they were scared of and a creepy driver / gardener. And of course, you know, like the kind of archetype of the very, very strict nun that I think scared me more than Mohini did.
Yeah, that's true. I think we were all more scared of her than Mohini. And then the whole idea of like, so it's not really the orphanage. If they could stay in the orphanage forever with the other little girls who became their family, that'd be fine. It's the prospect of having to leave the orphanage that it's like, you either get adopted into the dream or you go to a place where you're going to get caned for not having memorized 47 Bible verses someday. Which is not a good thing.
Writing the nun was a lot of fun, and I think I felt really bad because two of my friends went to sort of convent schools and had to really deal with nuns. Convent schools are very popular in Colombo and Sri Lanka in general. So it isn't unheard of that you'd have to deal with these really strict nuns. And a lot of it wasn't based on fiction. Like, these were real, a lot of them were real or real adjacent things that happened.
Real adjacent. That's my favorite new word.
That is a really good
word. It's real adjacent.
Derived from
I went to Catholic school when I was little, for many years, and I did get hit with a ruler. Like, that's just something that happened. And I'm not, like, so old that it's, like, way back in the olden days.
Right?
I'm like,
the 80s. Although it has been long enough now that, sadly, the 80s, that would be considered historical fiction now, Jen. We're old.
It's like we turn on the radio to, like, the oldies channel and you hear these pop songs.
And it's Madonna.
You're like, Tears for Fears is not an oldie. Would you stop? Seriously. Guys. I can't with you.
So,
okay, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so this is your debut novel. Is this...
Yes.
Yeah. Is this actually the first novel you've written, or are you, like, many, many of the authors we've talked to and ourselves that have multiple books that just, like, didn't go anywhere, that agents were like,
there's a trunk of books kind of thing, like, yeah, hidden under the bed.
So I
the have bad file on your computer that's just like just a frowny face.
There are a lot of ideas that didn't make it past, you know, that, like, starting point. But I have written one book before this where I it's a really funny story. It was just something that I wrote without really thinking about anything like the constraints of genre or, you know, things you're supposed to think about when you're writing a book. Because I had no idea what I was doing. I was just like, oh, la la, I have this idea. I'm just going to start writing a few pages. It was a really busy time in my life. Like, we were starting a new business. I was finishing off my master's and I had, like, little breaks in between, and I was just absolutely adamant that I would write a book and publish it, and get this, before my 30th birthday.
Wow!
So how happened for you, Amanda?
It is a fairy tale book.
Oh, yeah, what life, if not for setting up these random goalposts that and these deadlines that, you know, just do nothing.
Especially things that you have no control over once you write the book.
Yeah.
Like, oh yes, I'll be published by the time I'm 30.
Yeah. So it was...
you just need all the planets to align for that to happen.
Yeah. And when they didn't align, I published the book in Sri Lanka. And I got really lucky with it that it was locally, it was generally well-received. I won an award for it, like a local award for it and stuff. So I was really sort of heartened by this, which is what really kind of persuaded me to chase after publishing or pursue a traditional publishing deal. Because one thing that self-publishing taught me is that self-publishing really, really works for some authors. It just definitely did not work for me. You know, the
we understand.
I was going to say that actually is gospel. So go on.
Yeah.
that is true. I want to hear, you would mention though that you, when you were writing it, you weren't writing with any constraints, especially as to genre. So how would you describe that first book? What genres or collection melange of genres were you drawing from? And you can say any and all, that's fine, but what can you tell us a little bit about it? Especially because I don't think I have access to Sri Lankan bookstores.
I love the laughter.
Oh my god. Oh dear, go on. Okay, just tell us if we're wrong. Are there vampires?
No, it was
erotic private detective?
No.
Okay, go ahead, Amanda. We'll stop.
Not erotic. I'm not that gifted, unfortunately. No, it was a steampunk mystery. It was one of those things where I think I couldn't be bothered to do any historic research. So
we've all been there.
My old world, because that would be easier.
The idea of world building being easier than research is like, that sounds true. It is not.
No. Exactly. It's not like it was easy, but at the time it just seemed like a good idea. And then afterwards, I remember I gave it to, like, one of my good friends who was a first reader, and he was like, "Oh, it looks like steampunk." And I was like, "Aha! Exactly.
It's not just poorly researched historical fiction."
Pretty much. Pretty much. No, it was a lot of fun. It really got me, I think, thinking, asking myself a lot of big questions, like, is this really what I want to be writing? You know, and kind of being, it took a while for me to really understand, okay, like, I have to be true to myself here, which is why I have since let go of really writing in that space.
Nice. And,
yeah, I focus more on, I mean, with everything that I've written or been really interested in, there is sort of this running theme in that there has to be some mystery or something that drives it forward. Just because, see, growing up in Sri Lanka, I didn't have a ton of access to, I think, more American titles. Like growing up, we read a whole lot of Enid Blyton in Sri Lanka. It was like the popular book. So a lot of Famous Five, Secret Seven. You know, these ideas that are a bunch of kids and they're trying to solve a mystery. And mm-hmm. I think that's really...
It's the Babysitter's really, Club.
A little... I kind of like...
Don't solve mysteries.
Don't they? I don't know. I never read them.
That's more like the Bloodhound Gang or maybe Nancy Drew, but with extra friends. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it is very, very Nancy Drew. So like when I was a little older and was able to get a little bit more access, like Nancy Drew was what I sort of reached towards. Babysitter's Club had that one, I remember. It was the first Babysitter's Club book I bought was, I think it was something about like the missing ring, Stacy, and like the missing, like she was babysitting and a diamond ring goes missing and they try to find it. So I was
always loved that one.
See, I was so hoping you were going to say it was the one where Claudia thinks she's adopted. Did you ever read that one? No. There's one where she thinks she's adopted, and it's simply because her parents didn't take as many baby pictures of her because she was the second child. So she gets it in her head that, like, why are there baby pictures? I don't have, am I adopted? Like, all.
No, your parents were just exhausted.
It was thing, but it's like, no, Claudia, you're not adopted.
Sure. No, I love the Babysitter's Club. We didn't have all the titles over here. It was something that, like, you would luck into. So, yeah, it was just, I just loved things with, like, books with mysteries in it or stories with mysteries in it that need to be solved. If there were more, like, the more plot twists, the better. So, so yeah, it just, I think it was only a matter of time till I figured out, hey, like, that's the kind of thing I want to be like. So
that's still carried over from the earlier book. You're just like, maybe the setting won't be random steampunk or steampunk by default or something.
Like, so all right, I totally meant to write a steampunk novel. I definitely did.
Intentional.
Yeah, at the time, I was like, yeah, I love steampunk. and it's cool. Like, it's not that I don't like steampunk. I do like reading sort of in that fantasy space. I mean, it's funny because steampunk's technically considered like, I think that's sci-fi fantasy, like,
fully know. And I read one recently, I'm like,
I would think of it as sci-fi meets fantasy.
Kind of, but there's that historical element, but it feels like it's kind of its own thing.
Because they have flying machines.
Flying machines, everything.
But everybody's, you know, wearing automata. Corsets.
Yeah, everyone's like wearing corsets.
Because
and
of the,
just for reasons.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah. It was, if you're confused, I was too.
Okay, so you settled on this, and this is contemporary set, although because we do have, for anybody who hasn't read it yet, go read it, but you will see that there's dual narration, and I just want to say, and I said as much beforehand, that I got to listen to it on Audible, and your narrator, just, she was fabulous, and she handles all the accents, she handles, like, because you're also with the younger version of these mm-hmm. characters in the orphanage, and she sounds like a convincing kid, but then can go into, like, this hardened San Francisco young woman who's just like, shit, I gotta go to this bar. And like, she's grumbling and, you know, yes, Sam, thank you, Sam. And then goes back to being this sweet little child. And it's so cute, but well, any punches, I'll just put it that way.
She is so amazing. I remember I got on a call with her because we had to iron out, you know, some of the Sri Lankan pronunciation and things like that.
Yeah.
And she just, towards the end of the call, and I really liked her, and, you know, we were vibing, everything was great. And then towards the end of the call, she goes, oh yeah, by the way, do you want me to read it like this? And she reads these like two lines from the story. And I was just like my jaw just hung open. I was like, it's Paloma.
It's Paloma.
Hi Paloma, how are you?
you know, it was like, oh, please don't say mean things about me in your head, Paloma. it was so spot on. I was absolutely blown away. You know, and that was something we were very kind of sensitive to when we were trying to find a narrator. It's someone who's able to do these Sri Lankan accents as a child.
Yeah.
And then, you know, grows up to have this, you know, very mean girl-esque sort
who
of
has almost, yeah, you know, she has almost no accent. But then she's still, but the narrator's also still doing voices like Sam, who is also Sri Lankan, but a man, and be able to sound like that and sound convincingly like a man too. So amazing.
Yeah, she was fantastic. Absolutely blew my mind.
Loved well, hopefully it. You have her on the hook for all your other books, and maybe if you bribe her, she'll go do your first one too.
No, maybe not the first one, but definitely for, for the next
one. How do you feel about steampunk? Like, I'll do it. I'll do it. It's good. It's all good.
So I have to ask this about like everybody that we have that writes mystery, because I love mystery. I always think like, oh, I want to write a mystery. I want to write something, but like I'm bad at planning and I never know the end of the book.
We are both pantsers. So we're like, mystery, huh?
So I always have to ask, like, I know like we talked a little bit before the show that you had a different version of the ending in mind. But you had an ending in mind, which to me already was like, that's great. Because I write going, I don't know where this is going. Are you somebody who has to plan it out? Like, do you have one of those serial killer boards, like in your house where like everything's
she
like,
looks over.
She's like, it's
right, Amanda, what's over there?
It's either Mohini or the serial killer board, or Mohini holding the serial killer board.
Oh, no, I definitely. So going into this, I actually knew 100% what the big reveal slash plot twist, like the main one, I knew what that was, because I was actually using that on another story. That was not working because I couldn't get the setting and the narrator's voice right in any way, just was not gelling together. And it's really funny because I actually had this really terrible, almost like a meltdown, but they didn't know it was a meltdown, with my bank, and I was just really, really angry. And I went to, you know, afterwards I went to a coffee shop and I, you know, ordered a big cup of coffee and I started like rage writing all this stuff in this really
mean. So, is that how you got your first
there's
scene?
There's your opening.
There's your opening.
That's like 100% where that first scene came from, where, you know, you're stuck at a bank and you have to play nice. And your jaw's aching because you're smiling so hard, but inside you just want to like, you know, you want to
break through the plexiglass.
Yeah.
The special place in hell for bad customer service representation.
Oh yeah, for sure. And so that's where sort of Paloma's voice came in. And then I was like, oh, okay, maybe I could. And then I ripped apart that old story that I was working on, just took out the elements that I, there's just one big element that I liked. And plug it in with this story in sort of the Sri Lanka, San Francisco setting. And I felt like it came together. So there is a certain element of pantsing in that I'll map out the main plot twists and kind of where they would sort of, at what point I want them to be sort of, if there are reveals, when the reveal would happen or when the plot twist would happen, really. Now I have the great, absolute, amazing, wonderful advantage of being able to discuss it with, you know, like my agent and my editor, which I didn't have back in the day. So that's made the process a whole lot easier. And so I have a sort of a slightly cleaner outline, or it's not, never really a major outline. It's more like a beat sheet.
And do you mean for later books then?
Yeah, for later books. So with Paloma as well, I would have like a rough idea of where I want things to go. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that rough idea is followed, it's you know, we can just toss a coin.
And one of the things I really loved about, so you said you have this like a main twist, but there were multiple twists, and then there were also places where I was thinking, is this going to be, and then it wasn't. So you had so many places. I mean, I literally said my head is spinning because I'm like, is this going to be, oh no, then it isn't. Oh, but then, oh, that's not what I thought was going to happen, because it was like you were directing us towards one way. And then the last minute, it's like, oh no, look over there. I was getting whiplash reading this, but yet everything was still, it all still made sense. Yeah. It there was never something like, I've read certain books where it's like, oh, I didn't see it coming. And I didn't see it coming because the author really just pulled a Houdini and pulled something out of left field and said, here's the ending. And you're like,
you just made that up.
You just threw it in. And there's no way that I, as a reader, could have detected it, that even on a second read, there would not have been hints. Whereas if I were to go reread this, I would be seeing more hints and go, oh, I see what you're doing now. Oh, I see where that leads in. And I can't think that could have just happened naturally in one draft. You had to have multiply figured out where these are and then put those little early seeds.
And especially you had such a, I don't want to say like, for some of the minor twists, I don't want to say they were throwaway, but they just kind of very seamlessly, you were in the character's head. And yeah. I was like, yes, I love that. It wasn't like,
I think I know which one you mean.
Yeah.
Or one of the ones you mean where you're
there were I think two or three that I was like, yes, I love that.
and I know at least one of them I saw coming, but then the second part as far as what that led to, not so much. I'm like, oh that makes sense.
I think with twists it's interesting because personally I love a good twist, and if there are many of them, that's what I like. And I remember chatting about this with my agent, even for the next book, is that what's really nice is if you have that twist and then you have that little at the end where it's like, is it? You know, and you have that like little thing again, which is like a little mini. And for me, the more they're peppered in, the better the story is as far as it makes sense to the plot. And in my case, it was a lot of the twists, and I think I know which ones you're referring to. A lot of that really, for me, was laying the groundwork for Paloma's character, because a lot of what happened, obviously, is what led to her being this absolute, you know, hot train wreck woman unraveling and trying to get some semblance of control over her life, but failing at it. Mm-hmm. That's a result of everything that happened to her. I mean, people don't just wake up one day and decide to, you know, go on benders and
everything she was made perfect sense once we figured out everything that she had been through. Like, I just was like, I get it. I get all of it. I also really want to say I liked her side hustle.
That's
great way to make money.
Is this podcast allowed to talk about that?
No, I read a few interviews of women who engage in side hustles. to that, and I was like,
she doesn't sell Tupperware, folks. Let's just put it that way.
It's not multi-level marketing.
No, that was a really weird way to recruit people.
I don't even want to say what it is, but it was really handled well. It was funny. I know people who do similar things.
I won't say what it is, but it reminded me. I saw something on Twitter about someone who. She was selling her farts in a jar.
Oh, I saw something.
And she ended up in the hospital because apparently the way she was eating was intentionally to give her really bad gas, and eventually it got too hard, and she was like in the hospital because you can't eat like that forever.
I did read something like that. I didn't read it on Twitter. I think I actually saw it on a news site.
But like, I mean, you have to. I mean, I've started businesses. I mean, very, very, you know, like mainstream businesses now. Like,
things are great.
I'm like, you can't help but really admire the entrepreneurial like mindset of some.
Yeah.
Like, kudos to them.
Her profit margin was great.
Mm-hmm. I bet.
You know, I was like, look at that. I was just 20 years younger and hotter.
I don't know if any of that matters. It's not equivalent to sell your farts in a jar.
No, I don't want to do that. That's the one I don't want to do.
What, would you be anonymous though? Like, if you could anonymously sell your farts in a jar, would you?
But I think some of it must be because she was probably like a hot girl.
I'm sure some of it was.
But
hot enough.
You know, I'm not going to kink shame. Whatever people want, whatever makes you happy, whatever you want to spend your money on, it could be worse. It could be drugs. Like,
I mean, I got nothing. I just wrote the book.
No, I just I mean, it's one of those things where it's like Paloma is not apologetic about her side hustle, and that was important to me too. You know, that it's not something necessarily that she's ashamed of. It could have some repercussions, like, you know, that she got a little paranoid about, you know,
a bit
early on there. But it's definitely, I mean, no shame. A girl's got to do what a girl's got to do. Hey, so.
As she's getting, because she's getting her freelance business getting going. And hey, you need a side income while you're getting a business started. Everybody knows that.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think OnlyFans wasn't a thing when I was talking. Anyway, I would think, you know, so.
So on that note, people are now like, wait, there's a, what's going on in this book?
This book and everything. You appeal to a whole new demographic orphans. You were probably not trying to appeal to right now.
It's a very, very minor.
Good demographic.
Don't read it for that.
Yeah.
Really don't read it for the side hustle. Read it for the scotch drinking and the blackouts.
Yeah. And pretty much. Yeah. That should be like the tagline.
Yeah. I could. Yeah, you can put that on your cover.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so you said that now you have more of a beat sheet and you were able to kind of have these, you know, your editor and your agent to work through things with. So what are you working on now and when can we have it in our hot little hands?
Yeah.
It's
and do you need early readers?
I think you have two volunteers right here.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. No, it's done. It's with the team at Berkeley, and you know, we're in that production stage. That's really exciting. Where, you know, I'm seeing covers, and it's you know, people are finally having those conversations going about it, which is really exciting. It is of course it is another suspense. It is this time it's based completely in Sri Lanka. But a different type of Sri Lanka to the orphanage, because this time it's in Colombo 7, which is okay. Very sort of bougie, upper-class Colombo society. And it takes place around a Sri Lankan wedding. And yeah, it was a lot of fun to write. Again, it's like, you know, I feel like my books have this mean streak to them.
And you seem so pleasant.
And we're not complaining at all.
I think wasn't your dedication in the book, was it like to your husband or something, that's like, thank you for forgiving me when I'm being a total Paloma?
No, it is,
I've read that and I'm like, I'm gonna love her.
No, it's really funny because I do I think, like, when I was younger, I did a lot of sort of theater acting stuff like that, and I could totally understand, and I wouldn't do this, of course, but like, I could totally understand like method actors and why they would be a certain way, because you need to kind of get into that mindset. And when I was writing Paloma, I 100% had to get into that like mean girl mindset. And
so you're basically a method writer is what you're telling us.
Yeah, it's like such a funny thing to say, right? But I definitely do start like thinking like that. And like through the day when I'm going through like just like my daily business, I'd be thinking, I was like, oh, like, what's a snarky, like, I'd be thinking snarky things to myself just to get into that, like, headspace of, like, just being mean. I wouldn't say it out loud, but, I mean, things do slip out every once in a while, usually towards the direction of my poor, poor husband, who is so, I mean, he's so patient, and kind of, there have been so many times where he just, like, looked at me, and he's like, all right, can you, like, stop being a Paloma now? My wife.
I love that it's like a phrase.
My wife.
It is.
Don't be a Paloma.
Is he where you get some of the inspiration then for Sam? Because I loved Sam and just like how he's like, so I'm not saying that I don't like partying with you when you're completely crazy drunk, but maybe just we tone it down, maybe just a little bit. I didn't mean to scare you. And you told me to call you, and I just have food. I mean, he's bringing food. How can you not love someone who's just showing up like, what kind of food would you like?
Like, it's like the best thing to do, right? And I definitely, like, that bit was straight up from my husband. It's like, I'll be, you know, having a Paloma day, and he'd know, like, the thing to do is to feed me. He's like, here,
yes.
I would look for you. And he is a fantastic cook, so it works out really, really well for me. But yeah, definitely that, like, I really wanted this contrast between Sam and Paloma, because Paloma is someone who's obviously been through it, right? Like, she's been through it, and that's why she is who she is. And obviously she's jaded. Obviously she's bitter. Obviously she's had enough of it. And Sam is based, I mean, obviously, like, there's a really good nature that comes from my husband and, you know, a lot of sort of guys I know who are just very, like, I feel like that sense of innocence almost. And he's actually based on most strongly on this guy I did meet when I was in the US, who was just so bought into this idea of like the American dream and how he was just so thankful to be there because it was hard. And it is hard for Sri Lankans to get over there, right? It's not like, you know, you can just wake up one day and decide like, hey, I'm just going to buy a plane ticket and fly over there because we don't have a very good passport. Like just even applying for holiday visa is an effort. And, you know, if you're going there for like actual like, university or trying to live there, it's very, very expensive. And the average Sri Lankan would really struggle to get over there. So when you get over there, you're usually pretty darn grateful and very sort of blue-eyed, optimistic, glasses half. And
every day's a musical.
Yeah, and it was funny. There was this one guy that I met who was so much like that in the US. I met him only very briefly. He was dating a girl in my dorm, and I remember he like really struck that like chord with me, and he kept like trying to speak to me in Sinhalese, which at the time I kind of annoyed him, but I found it really, really comforting. But it was really nice.
Paloma, and like, could you not?
Like, please stop. And that bit was from, I think I have cousins who grew up not in Sri Lanka and obviously didn't get the chance to speak much Sinhalese. And they're so fed up of Sri Lankans going up to them, like whenever they see, meet another Sri Lankan, even a complete stranger in public. And they come up to them and just like start rattling off like, oh, like, can you speak in Sinhalese? Like, you're from Sri Lanka. And obviously that's a very normal reaction. I mean, even for me, if I were to meet someone from Sri Lanka, and like say in the Bay Area, if I ever were to meet a stranger who was Sri Lankan, the first thing I was like, huh, like how they
may. And you might be like, yeah, or maybe.
And I remember the guy that I met, and he was probably like totally being a Paloma in his head. I remember he was just like, uh-huh. And he was like, oh, which means yes. And then he's like, but I grew up here, so I don't really speak it. Like, I can kind of understand it, but I can't really speak it. And I think that's a frustration that a lot of, I think, like, Sri Lankans who are living abroad or who have grown up abroad have to face. So,
well, especially if there's not a huge community around where you can continue to speak the language. A lot of other groups who come here, they're there with extended families and other communities, and there's like a little Saigon and areas where there's a dense ethnic population where you can probably keep speaking it. I don't know if you're going to find that when you come here if you're trying to speak Sinhalese. Like,
no,
you've got to take it where you can find it.
No, sure. I mean, it's very rare that like people even know where Sri Lanka is. And most of the time when I speak to, I think most of the Americans I met, they're like, oh, you're the first person from Sri Lanka that we've met, which has been pretty much, I mean, we're a very small country, of course, so it's only to be expected. Yes.
Well, Amanda, this has been amazing. I hate to say it. We are out of time. Everybody who's listening to this live or on our replay, go out and buy Amanda's book or order it on anywhere online, Amazon, bookshop.org. Listen to it. Amanda, you were great. Allison, you were great. This has been a copywritten podcast by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Stay tuned next week when we have the author of Defenestrate, Renee Branham. Sorry, almost said her name wrong. So she will be here next week. And thank you all so much.